This is Genetics in Your World, a podcast by the Genetics Society of America, where we delve into the latest genetics research featuring highlighted content from GSA journals. This is your host, Sarah Renee Phillips, a postdoctoral associate at Yale University. Today, we will be discussing the recent publication, Impact of Pathogen Genetics on Clinical Phenotypes in a Population of Tularemiasis marneffei, published in Genetics by Dr. Christina Cuomo, Professor of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Brown University and Director of Fungal Genomics at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, and her colleagues. They studied the genetic basis of pathogenesis of the fungal pathogen Tularemiasis marneffei in two groups of patients from northern and southern Vietnam, using a combination of population genomics and genome-wide association studies. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Cuomo.
Hi.
We're so happy to have you here today. And what I would like to do is just jump right into a little bit of background on you and how you became a scientist. So what brought you to the field of science for your career? Was it something that you knew you wanted from an early age, or were you inspired to become a scientist by some specific event or person?
Thinking back, I really had, you know, great exposure in the public schools I was in and around the Boston area to science education. I remember having very hands-on science activities in some of my schooling. And also Boston has this amazing Museum of Science for anyone in visiting the Boston area. I recommend it. And I was also just very encouraged by parents, in particular my mother, who had a master's degree in mathematics, who's very pro-science and math education, to take on additional enrichment. I remember having like a science kit to do extra activities and presenting science posters. So very, encouraged by my mother. And then, I mean, personally, kind of pre-going to college, there wasn't really a specific event or person, though I would say losing both my godparents to disease, my godfather to ALS and my godmother to cancer, I think contributed as well, because, you know, these were diseases where I watched them over a period of decline. These weren't sudden events that happened with other family members. And also got me thinking about, you know, ways to stop this from happening, having watched it happen, and thinking about, whether I might want to, I thought for a while, maybe I would be some kind of cancer scientist because of that. But it was the process of then when I was in college, I was at a liberal arts college and thought about science degrees as part of a liberal arts education, but really being in starting to work in labs was what kind of cemented it for me, that I really exposure to just the process of science and found it was something that I really enjoyed. The, you know, being able to do ask a question for the first time and that part, that process of discovery. And then for me, asking questions connecting back to that personal experience that were connected to human health is something I've carried through for my career.
That's lovely. It sounds like you were surrounded by science all the way through, very much a part of your environment. I'm curious, what was the first research laboratory you worked in? What was the main goals of that research laboratory?
It was after my sophomore year in college. It was a lab at the University of Massachusetts Medical School that was doing diabetes work. And they were looking at whether or not you could restore the production of islet cells in, you know, potentially for patients with type 1 diabetes to provide them with a natural source of insulin. And so we were looking at just the effects of some immunosuppressant drugs, but also they were doing some kind of transplantation of different cells to look at kind of restoring the production of those produced, those cells that were producing insulin.
So you have recently moved to a new academic appointment at Brown University in molecular microbiology and immunology. But you spent years at the Broad Institute, where you still maintain an affiliation. So for our early career scientists out there who might be curious about the Broad Institute, how does working at Broad compare to a more traditional academic research department?
Yeah, the Broad is a research institute that's affiliated with MIT and so through and also Harvard. And through those affiliations, there are a lot of trainees that work with faculty that are affiliated with the Broad. And so if in those ways, it's a lot like academic institutions, but it's the history of the Broad. And when I started there, it was really kind of focused as a, had a very genomics focus. And that was kind of more like a something leaning more towards industry a bit more, really working, you know, as part of very large collaborations with as part of big projects together, as part of interdisciplinary teams. And that's what it was like when I was there. I went there at the tail end of the Human Genome Project and worked on that for a year and then got to work on fungal genomics. And I really enjoyed that atmosphere of working on these big collaborative teams, which is very different from what was my experience working in academia. And so and when I say interdisciplinary teams, you know, working as someone who had to that point been laboratory bench trained and starting to learn computational, now working more with software engineers and computer scientists, in addition to the laboratory people performing genome sequencing. But that part of the genomics part, to be able to do it at the scale that they do it, is really the run like a, you know, it's a big operation, and that's really kind of a skill and a industrial level operation that they do. So just also kind of peering into that, you learn about kind of more industrial practices that go on in that part of the Broad. Now there's much even more things that go on as it's grown. There are again now more faculty affiliated with the Broad and located at the Broad. So there's a much larger academic side of the presence in addition to just more industrial collaborations. So for individuals being at the Broad, I guess the kind of landscape looking out and the way sometimes it's framed is that it's a it's sometimes called a matrix environment where it's not very hierarchical in the structure. There are something like departments, they call them programs, that you're a part of, but you might have connections to different parts of the Broad that you build through the projects that you develop. And it's not overly hierarchical in how those projects get run. There's opportunities for, there's a lot of opportunities to initiate projects for some junior scientists. And the way that you connect to people in different Broad platforms, for example, that develop all these new technologies is something that you kind of take the initiative to build and advocate for. So it's a definitely unique environment to be part of, but it's been particularly as genomics has really changed over the period of time that I was there, it was a very interesting place to be to see kind of how all those technology changed and was how then from the computational side, which is more the focus of my work, how we could use that and change both our the questions that we could ask and think about how that changed the science that we could do.
Right, how it sort of grew with the technology. It's interesting the way that you described the Broad. It seems to be structured very similarly to one of my first training grants that I had through NIH and Howard Hughes Medical, where there was sort of one person from a variety of disciplines, an anthropologist, a biologist, an electrical engineer, a computer scientist, a chemist. And we all worked on these joint problems or joint projects together, contributing our individual expertise.
Yeah, I think it's a really different, it was really different again from how I had been on teams up until then, but it's a really, I found it to be a really enriching way to work on projects, right? Because it's not just different skill sets even. It's really different ways of thinking that can be brought, right, to a project or a question.
Right.
That if you're open to hearing those different perspectives, you can think about science in different ways.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So as someone who has spent her career working on viruses and macroparasites, I know that fungal pathogens are often overlooked in infectious disease research, or if not overlooked, just received a little less attention, and the public seems to know a little bit less about them. Was that part of the impetus for choosing to work on this taxonomic group?
Yes, there's certainly a major challenge to address in infectious diseases in addressing fungal pathogens. There have unappreciated and enormous impact, despite the fact that they are causing an enormous amount of infections. So every year, billions of people worldwide will get infected by fungi, and it's estimated that they will kill in excess of 1.5 million people a year, which I just don't think people are aware of, because they're somewhat hidden killers. A lot of times they might be infecting people who are immunocompromised, who are, you know, in the hospital with other diseases, who then might get fungal infections. But of this, you know, the very large number of infections, they're also, those include some amount of superficial infections that many people will get. But of those very severe infections that cause death, you know, our current drugs are not sufficient to treat them. Obviously, right now, there's very high mortality associated with them. So then part of my work is to try and use genomic approaches to understand, right now, taking kind of a population genomic approaches like we did in this paper, looking at from the point of view of natural populations, how can we understand how pathogen genetic diversity might be contributing to the virulence? And what can that tell us about mechanisms that might give us some new clues about both how, you know, new targets for treatment, but also they might be markers for potential in the future guiding treatments to isolates that cause severe disease that would motivate faster treatment decisions potentially in the future. And then lastly, the large challenge that's been recognized, including by the WHO recently, when it developed a fungal pathogen priority list recently, is the challenge of drug resistance to the available drugs. So even the drugs we have right now, a challenge is that fungi are becoming resistant at an increasing rate. And part of the reason for some fungi is that there are similar classes of drugs that can be used medically as well as to combat fungal diseases of agriculture. There might be not the exact same drug, but a similar enough drug that you can get cross resistance, and the same fungal species is existing in the environment. So these are what's called it's a challenge that we need to think about not just in medical areas, but also in how we're using these similar drugs in the environment and potentially increasing drug resistance. Because again, right now, not just for the drugs we have, but as we develop new ones, if we're increasing resistance to them as well, that's going to be an ongoing challenge to stay ahead of.
Well, that's a lovely lead into the paper itself. So let's dive right into that. So could you give us a quick overview of this paper? There's a couple of things I really loved about this paper. And one is the way that it interrogated the evolution of the pathogen and really approached it from many different perspectives. And also the way in which you address crossing scales in the manuscript. So just give us a quick overview of what led to the study, what you hoped to accomplish in the beginning, and what you think your biggest take-home messages are from the work you and your colleagues carried out.
Right. So as I mentioned, we're interested globally at looking at how fungi cause disease and using genomic approaches to look at how fungal pathogens are evolving as a way to study mechanisms across pathogen populations. And to be able to do that, that really requires that we're able to leverage these large populations of typically clinical isolates. And so we form partnerships typically with clinicians to be able to work collaboratively on these projects together. And one such opportunity came about for the species in this paper, Tellurmices, on the kind of following up on a clinical trial that was conducted for Tellurmices. So this was led by Thuy Le, who helped to run this trial in Vietnam. And she published this work in the New England Journal of Medicine. They were comparing two different regimens for antifungal treatment in people with HIV and looking at whether they could replace the standard of care treatment with one that was easier to take and potentially less, had fewer side effects, and comparing those two regimens. And so from that trial, then they had collected from those patients the isolates, the Tellurmices isolates from those patients. And for some of them, the patients that they had followed over time, they also had multiple isolates for patients that, unfortunately, they were not able to stop the disease, where the patient came in and then over time they had to come back, they collected the isolate again. And yeah, what we'll talk about is then that gives us a picture of how the isolate is changing over time. So in then talking with Thuy, this isolate collection with its associated clinical metadata on how the patients fared during the infection and different properties that they measured during the clinical trial is a really rich source of data that we can use then as a proxy for how virulent the individual isolates are that we can compare to the genomic data. So both collaborating with Thuy, we generated genome sequence for all of these isolates. And then we carried out the study that's described in this paper. And so this was also motivated by the fact that there had not been any really large genomic study for this species previously. There had been a genome sequence that was published, and people had also been starting to do some transcriptional studies. And there had been a prior initial description of population subdivisions using a small number of genes in a technique called multi-locus sequence typing. But there hadn't been any deep population analysis to look at kind of across the genome, what are pressures on genes. So that was also a motivation for carrying out all of the sequencing, is to really have this first look into how the genome is evolving in this species.
And in an in vivo setting, which is something that's not, you know, always possible.
Yes, right.
So what do you think the biggest take-home messages are from the paper?
So one was that one thing that fell right out of the genomic data was that the isolates separated into these two subgroups, one from North and South Vietnam, and these are very strongly supported subgroups. And from those subgroups, then we could do a lot of comparisons about what was different between them. And we started out with just comparing the clinical metadata itself to look at if there was anything different between how the patients progressed between those two subgroups. And we did find that it appeared that the southern subgroup the isolates collected from that group appeared to be linked to more severe disease, suggesting there could be, there appeared to be some genetic basis for more severe outcomes in that group.
So for our listeners' sake, I'm just going to stop for a moment and kind of clarify that one of the interesting things about the results from this paper is that there is a really clear distinction in the two groups of patient isolates, one from northern Vietnam and one from southern Vietnam. And not only is there a very clear distinction in these two groups, but there's some indications from the phylogeny itself there might be some different things going on within those two groups evolutionarily, at least when you initially looked. There was one group, I think it was the smaller northern group, that had much longer branch links and the phylogeny sort of across the board than the southern group had. So you had, I think what you're saying is that you had this opportunity from the beginning to say, we might have some very different things going on here in terms of patient experiences or patient outcomes or epidemiology associated with such a distinct division in these two clades. Am I right in sort of that interpretation?
Right, right. Yeah, that's where we started, was just because we were then going to look further into using that data, and also just to look for any initial differences in the patient data between those two groups. Yes.
So Dr. Cuomo, I'm just going to reframe some of what we've talked about already. So despite observing these distinct north-south clades of fungal isolates, in almost all cases, you didn't find that the clinical phenotype sorted with that north-south dichotomy. But then you followed the study through with several different approaches, including genome-wide association studies and population genomics interrogations. Could you tell us a little bit about the important results that came from that work?
Sure. So we initially had planned to and carried through a genome-wide association, looking at variants that associated with a number of clinical phenotypes, measuring the severity of the clinical infection, such as the relapse of the infection, the mortality of the patient, and other phenotypes. And using that, we identified a number of variants in the population that seemed to identify loss of function common to genes that are different types of transporters, and also other genes, including transcription factors and other enzymes. So that was, those might suggest loss of function variants that are contributing to virulence differences in the population. But in addition, we carried out other population genomic analyses to look at just the genomic data itself to give us more resolution into the population. And we looked at copy number variation across the genome, just gains and losses of genomic regions. And when we did this, we found that there was a real enrichment for copy number variation near telomeric regions. So we had, as part of this project, generated two complete genome assemblies for North and South Vietnam isolates. And so we could use those to kind of pinpoint the location of telomeres and then map our reads and identify copy number variants kind of precisely along chromosomes. And so using that, we were able to show that copy number variants we identified really cluster at most of the telomeres in the genome, and that a lot of these regions are genes involved in heat stress and involved in the cell surface. So that was pretty interesting. That's kind of suggesting that the tellurimycetes is modifying things that are probably responding to stress. And then the last thing we did is we kind of, following up on the north-south dichotomy, we were very interested to know, as part of geographic separation and also a little bit of this maybe difference in virulence, if there was anything else differentiating these two populations. And so we compared genomic regions under selection between the two groups. And here, what we found to be the most diverging were genes involved in metabolism and also, again, transcription factors. So the genes involved in metabolism are also kind of interesting to think about, if that might be something that kind of along between the two geographic regions might be more or less important. All of this is kind of we're generating a lot of new information here because there's so little known about this genome previously. So a lot of kind of food for thought.
So you mentioned at the beginning of that there was some association potentially of certain types of variants with different epidemiology or different epidemiological like features, which might be really important to our listeners. Can you talk a little bit about sort of that scaling up of the variants that you found that might be associated with different epidemiology?
We're talking about when we did the GWAS for variants associated with, right? So when we do the GWAS, we start with the clinical metadata, and for kind of each clinical phenotype that we're interested in, we perform a genome-wide association scan. And we start looking at the variants that are predicted to most impact gene function. So starting with kind of variants that are in genes and variants that either are causing non-synonymous or loss of function variants within genes. And so the list of variants that we focused on and highlight within the paper are those that are disrupting gene functions and are associated with these different clinical phenotypes. The most common one was just a poor clinical response. And as I said, the most common category were different types of transporters. So that is suggesting, I guess, just, you know, nutrient acquisition might be a major factor differentiating the different growth or virulence level of these different pathogens, or something to look at further, I would say.
Interesting.
And then something, you know, more kind of at a finer scale that we looked at were these isolates that we haven't talked about yet, were these isolates taken from the same patient that I alluded to that look just over time at,
right?
Yeah, or isolates taken from same patient, different body sites, or isolates taken from the same patient at different times. And those can provide a window into microevolution, but also tell you something about the kind of recurrence of infection. And we do see that in some of these cases that the number of variants that you see is supporting that multiple isolates have infected some of these patients. So it's not just it's not always just a clonal propagation of the same isolate, that some patients have been infected, but appears to be more than one isolate. So we're kind of, yeah, limited in our sampling approach that we, you know, in a lot of fungal epidemiology, we take a single isolate that represents like the isolate and the infecting isolate and the population. But we're starting to realize we need to think a bit more broadly, and that there might be a population of isolates in the patient, and that we need to consider that.
Very interesting. So it's so much, the coverage in this paper is so much. And you already alluded to the fact that a lot of the reason for that is because so much of this is uncharacterized. So I'm very curious about your goals. Now that you have all the things that you've learned from this paper, what line of research do you think your lab would be most likely to pick up and carry on from the results that you found in this manuscript?
So from this paper, one thing that we would like to see carry forward is testing individual genes for roles in virulence. And what that would be dependent on is being able to do genetic manipulation in this organism, which is not our area of expertise. So that's kind of thinking something way forward. But another is that we're taking some of this genomic information working with and sharing it back with Thuy, who's also has another project working on diagnostics for tellurmices, and using this to inform the performance of her molecular diagnostic. So that's also a big area of needed improvement for fungal pathogens. It's not just the treatments, but also just knowing what you have, and so having rapid, accurate diagnostics.
Well, thank you for that. It really, truly is a comprehensive paper that interrogates a lot of different aspects of pathogen evolution at various scales and in various contexts. And I found it very interesting and also very critical to our times and understanding these emerging fungal pathogens. I like to end things on inspiration and leadership. It's a big emphasis in the Genetic Society of America. And when we find inspiring and strong leaders, we like to interrogate them too. So here I would like to ask, what inspires you and what outside influences do you draw upon to feed your science?
I would say that I am inspired by having the opportunity to go to kind of local art exhibitions in the area. Fortunate in the Boston and Providence area to have a lot. And when I was at the Broad, they have also prioritizing having artists in residence and thinking about having them come and have small exhibitions within the Broad. And I think it got me thinking about kind of the visual aspects of what we do and the how to present our work, but also just a kind of resetting your mind and thinking outside of what you're doing.
I love that. What is your vision for your laboratory and your science in the next few years?
Well, I'm just recently come to Brown University. So part of my vision is, establishing a group at a new university and one that now is involving undergraduates instead of, formerly being at a research institute where that wasn't the case. And my vision is training. And a big part of my vision is helping to promote the next generation and realize their potential as scientists as they move forward. And then for my own work to think about the, meeting the challenges of some of the fungal pathogens that I work on. We do a lot of work right now on Candida and Cryptococcus, in addition to the Tularemices project we're talking about today. And being able to ask the big questions. I think we have always, part of being at a place where, genomics has always been changing, is kind of always had the opportunity to kind of reinvent or change what you're doing often. And so, I feel like as part of that, moving here and thinking about what I'll be doing now, just thinking about, again, about what new questions in different ways I want to ask.
And how your new colleagues might influence that as well, right?
Yes.
So I love lightning round questions and answers and thought it would be fun to end our conversation that way. So I'm going to ask you a series of short questions and you'll answer in just one or two words the first thing that comes to your mind. What word best describes you?
I guess I would say committed.
What word would you use to describe a strong leader?
Not a single word, but I think of someone who lifts other people up.
Who is your favorite scientist?
I have on my bookshelf a feeling for the organism. So Barbara McClintock.
On long lab days, do you listen to music or podcasts?
I do both, but I would choose music.
What is your favorite lab activity?
I don't know favorite, but a place I can easily find myself is just assembling genomes.
Outside of science, who inspires you?
I'll choose Yo-Yo Ma.
What is your most creative non-curse word for laboratory mishaps?
Being from the Northeast, I feel like I should say wicked something, but I wicked, just say wicked, wicked bad.
Nice. Thanks. Dr. Cuomo, thank you for joining us today. I thoroughly enjoyed this new manuscript from your lab and the way that you interrogated this fungal pathogen system to understand its evolution within and between patients. I know our listeners will appreciate your work and efforts to address the role of fungal pathogens as emerging infectious diseases, and we all look forward to more work from your research group.
Thank you.
The Genetics in Your World podcast is produced by the multimedia team of the Early Career Leadership Program of the Genetics Society of America. We invite you to visit the Society's website, genetics-gsa.org, for more information on how you can get involved with the genetic scientific community. Thank you for spending time with us, and we hope to meet you again for our next episode.